This evening's talk is about the practice of generosity, a seamless circle of joy and contentment. Over 2,500 years ago, Gautama Buddha, with his most deep and profound generosity of heart, offered the teachings and the practices of liberation, liberation from suffering. He offered them directly out of his own experience. And for centuries following this, these teachings and practices have continued to be offered out of the generous heart of thousands of other beings all over the world. It's said in an ancient Buddhist legend that many, many mahakalpas, a measurement of huge amount of time, many, many mahakalpas and world cycles ago, before our Buddha, Buddha Gautama, came to be, another Buddha, Dipankara Buddha, was to pay a visit to a small village, the village of Amaravati in India, and offer an evening of public talks revealing his Dharma. The villagers were very, very excited and felt deeply honored to show their great respect for the Buddha Dipankara. They decided to level out and cover with a very fine cloth the whole length of the road that the Buddha would walk on as he went through the village. In the forest, just outside Amaravati, lived a young man who was blessed with all goodness, physical beauty, intelligence, friendliness, kindness, and great moral vigor. He was called the Hermit Sumedha, who in a much later lifetime was to be the future Buddha, our Buddha, Gautama Buddha. Sumedha's parents were wealthy Brahmins, and they had died just a few years before this story, before the visit of Dipankara Buddha, leaving their son, Sumedha, with 7 generations of accumulated wealth, great property, and great, great wealth. It's said that this young man, Sumedha, thought, "My family has amassed much, much wealth. Yet, neither my parents nor any of my ancestors were able to keep it, were able to take it with them upon leaving this world. What's the point of amassing more? One day I'll die too. As there's a road that leads beyond suffering in this world, why should I remain idle? No, I'll leave this sheltered life," Sumedha thought. "I'll become an ascetic. I'll find the way." And so he announced his intention to the king, and he gave all of his money to the poor, and he let his hair grow very long and matted, became a yogi. He practiced energetically, very energetically, whether standing, sitting, or lying down. And within a fairly short time, he gained a very profound insight into the nature of things. And he bore a very bright wisdom which was never to be dimmed. It said that he sat for many, many days, blissfully absorbed in his newfound sense of freedom and understanding. On the day of Dipankara Buddha's visit to the village, Sumedha was roused out of his deep meditation by all of the excitement and activity in the town, in the village. And it said that, seated cross-legged, he rose up into the air and flew through the forest until he came to the road. And he looked down and he said, "What's all the excitement about? Why are you working in the midday heat? Why is the road being leveled and covered with golden cloth?" "Venerable Sumedha," replied the workman, "don't you know the Dipankara Buddha? He's approaching the village." Well, Sumedha's heart just leapt with joy. "A Buddha," he thought. "Rare is it even to hear the word Buddha. Rare beyond all comprehending is it to meet such a fully realized one." So he immediately flew down from his airy perch and he offered to help the workman with the road. And he picked a particularly swampy stretch of ground, very low ground, to fill in. And he worked with his heart and his mind very light, full of joy, and repeating to himself as he was working over and over again, "A Buddha, a Buddha." But before he was able to finish his task, he heard exquisite music and chanting, and he saw flowers being tossed in the air. The Buddha Dipankara was close. He was about to approach. Sumedha saw multi-hued rays of light extending from the Buddha Dipankara, and a great golden light surrounding him. And then he thought, "Here's one who has attained all wisdom. Here's one who's free from all greed, all anger, all ego delusion. One in whom all goodness has been realized. I shall make an offering to the Buddha Dipankara in honor of all that he is." Sumedha spread his bark cloth cape. He wore clothes of bark. He spread his bark cloth cape over the soft, wet ground, and then he lay down upon it. And he loosened his long hair and spread it all around, making a passage of himself for the Buddha Dipankara to walk on over the mud. Then he thought, "Like the Buddha Dipankara, I want to help all beings. I'm determined. Despite all the difficulties, despite all the danger, I'll never turn back. I'm resolved to attain what the Buddha Dipankara has attained and benefit all beings." The next moment, after he made this resolve, the Buddha Dipankara arrived right at the spot. And looking down at Sumedha, he knew. He said to himself, "This hermit has made a resolution to be a Buddha. He'll be successful. In many mahakalpas and world cycles from now, he'll become a fully realized one, an awakened one, a Buddha. And his name will be Gautama." And out loud, Buddha Dipankara, who was surrounded by thousands of people, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, children. Out loud, he said, "In many Mahakalpas and world cycles from now, this hermit lying here will fulfill his great vow. He will be a Buddha named Gautama. When he becomes a young man, he'll see the four signs: old age, sickness, death, and a monk. And he'll leave his ordinary life in search of the deepest truths. After great exertions and near death, he'll receive a life-saving meal of rice milk. And with renewed strength, renewed energy, he'll go to the foot of a bo tree, sit himself down, and continuing his efforts with great diligence, he'll attain supreme Buddhahood." Well, Sumedha, lying there in the mud and hearing this, became totally delirious with joy. "My deepest wish shall be attained. I shall be a Buddha." Sumedha put his palms together, honoring the Buddha Dipankara, who did the same in return, and who continued on his way, accompanied by thousands of monks and nuns and lay followers from all walks of life. The Bodhisattva Sumedha, the word Bodhisattva means, sattva is a being, in this case a human being, and Bodhi is enlightenment, a being or human being who's devoted, who's dedicated to awakening. The Bodhisattva Sumedha, at that point, after the Buddha walked on by, arose from his bed of generosity and, filled with great joy and strength, tremendous strength of purpose, he rose up into the air again and he flew back. He returned to his forest retreat, where he remained working very hard towards his goal. Generosity is a practice. It's a practice of both offering and receiving. It's a process which very clearly helps to purify and transform the contraction of separateness engendered by self-centeredness. The practice of generosity offers us the possibility of purification and transformation of greed, of covetousness, of fear, of attachment. Generosity, it's really a perfectly natural aspect of our humanness, and it's universally recognized as one of the most basic human virtues. We offer, we receive. It's a seamless circle going on all the time. Just as the Bodhisattva Sumedha so diligently and so deeply practiced and cultivated generosity, we also cultivate and manifest it in a thousand different ways, no matter our culture, no matter our age, no matter who we are. I'm weeding and cultivating my garden early one summer morning many years ago. My 2.5-year-old son wanders over to my work area, and with a great big bright smile on his face, he th- thrusts a bunch of wildflowers that he's just picked, thrusts them at me. And I receive them with delight and a very heartfelt gratitude. I happen to be in China at the time of my 46th birthday. The friend that I was traveling with and I were staying in Shanghai in a two-room apartment with a Chinese family who were very good friends of my friend. The 20-year-old daughter of the family, it was a mother, a father, and two children that lived in the two rooms, plus us. The 20-year-old daughter of the family had admired my favorite bracelet that I was wearing quite a number of times, actually. And I'd learned that in China, it's customary to give gifts on your birthday. So, you already know. In the midst of some degree of spending, of experiencing actually a fair amount of attachment to my bracelet, I decided to give it to this young woman, to the daughter of the family, because it was my birthday, to give her a gift for my birthday. Though in the process of thinking about it, I was really feeling kind of like a one-handed giver. But when the time came to actually give it to her, give her the gift, it was with both hands that I gave it to her, with both hands and an open heart. And it truly was a joy, though I have to say that through the process of getting to that point of it being a joy, it was a very strong practice of generosity for me. Last summer in New Mexico, not too far from where I live, thousands of acres of forest fire raged in the Española and Los Alamos area. And hundreds of individuals and families were evacuated from their homes. Almost immediately, there was an enormous outpouring of generosity coming for miles around. Clothing, food, all of the ordinary daily life needs, offers of housing. So much offered freely that at some point we were told it was time to stop giving. The needs of all of those suffering because of the fire had been met with great abundance. A very dear friend of mine had waited quite a number of years for all of the conditions in her life to come together to allow her to sit the three-month retreat at the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. And finally, they do all come together one year. But 1 week before the retreat begins, she calls me. And she tells me that she's given up her spot because a very dear friend who's dying of cancer has asked her if she might consider being her caretaker. And so that becomes her retreat. A young cab driver in Thailand, he and I have a very inspiring conversation about Buddhism as he's taking me somewhere. And just as I'm getting out of his taxi, he takes a small bronze statue that's sitting on the dashboard of his taxi, a statue of his very beloved Buddhist teacher. He takes it off the dashboard and he gives it to me. And I hesitate momentarily. I'm not sure how to receive this gift or if I can receive this gift. And then all of a sudden my heart just simply opens and it's easy to accept this purity of generosity from this young man. A A 3-year-old Native American child from the Iroquois tribe sits in the middle of a circle, surrounded by many blood relatives and many members of the extended family. There are delicious foods, beautiful clothing, blankets, all sitting close to the child in the middle of the circle. After eating and drinking her fill and exploring the clothing and the blankets, a voice from outside the circle calls, "I'm hungry." And then another voice calling, "I'm thirsty." Another voice calling, "I'm cold." The child is then led out of the circle to share the food, share the drink with the hungry and the thirsty, and share the blankets with the cold one. It's a ceremony. It's a training of the heart towards compassionate generosity in the Iroquois tribe. I'm attempting to feed my 7-month-old granddaughter, and she picks up a piece of banana and very delightedly stuffs it into my mouth. Generosity. At some point along the way of your life, you decide you want to sit a retreat, maybe this retreat. And all of the conditions come together, and you give yourself, and you receive this great gift of practice. You're here. And someone opens the door and steps aside and lets you pass through first. This generosity received with a feeling of gratitude, of appreciation inside. Each day after lunch is finished in our staff and teacher eating space, somebody volunteers to takes it upon themselves to pick up, collect all the dishes and all the utensils and take them into the dining room and rinse them off for everybody else sitting together eating. At our Thursday evening sit in our small meditation center in Taos, New Mexico, we ask for volunteers for some construction and some painting, some finishing touches on our small center. And one of the carpenters in the Sangha volunteers. He comes in on his day off, and he comes in another time or two after he finishes his work. And then a few weeks later, we ask again for volunteers for help with another task. And again, he very brightly offers. And I kind of look a little surprised at him. And he says, "Oh, I'm so happy to help. More merit." Imagine yourself standing outside your house each morning, holding a bowl of food. A line of saffron-robed monks is moving very slowly, gracefully down the road, each one of them holding a round begging bowl. And as they pass in front of you, as you're standing in front of your house, you scoop out a portion of the food from your bowl and put it into each of the monks' bowls. Every morning, imagine yourself as a child, standing with your mother or your father or an older sister or brother, and seeing this ritual, this offering each morning, taking in the power of the generous heart, so very clearly present in this daily practice of generosity. taking in the joy and the genuine happiness that's quite apparent in this purity of giving. The benefits of generosity easily learned each day. This is from the Buddha. Just as 100 peaked, lightning garlanded, thundering cloud raining on the fertile earth fills the plateaus and gullies, even so a person of conviction and learning, wise, having stored up provisions, gives to those in need, delighting in giving. This is how his or her thunder, like a raining clouds, that shower of merit, abundant, rains back on the one who gives. The Buddha taught, if you knew what I knew about generosity, you wouldn't let one meal go by without sharing it. The Buddha and his nuns and monks all lived the same simple way, making alms rounds with their begging bowls each day for their sustenance. The Buddha taught and lived a way of life, not a philosophy, but a way of life. He said, thus you must train yourselves. We will be thankful and grateful. Not even the least thing that is done for us shall be forgotten. Giving and receiving, the practice of generosity. Here in Israel, and probably throughout the whole Middle East, and certainly in the United States and the rest of the Western world, we don't have this kind of daily experience, this reminder. We neither have the monastic training, most of us, of the begging bowl, which in part is a process of an ongoing cultivation and deepening of gratitude, of appreciation via the kindness shown to us. We don't have that. We don't live with that. Nor do we engage in offering food each day to those who depend on it for their sustenance, which cultivates an open, connected, joyous heart of generosity. Rather, primarily, our cultures encourage us to yearn for, to acquire, to accumulate, and then to fixate and cling to our accumulations, material accumulations, and the accumulation of opinions and views that support this whole materialistic culture. We're conditioned in this, by this process, to identify ourselves outwardly and inwardly through all of our accumulations, material and otherwise, and to think and to feel that this is who we are. In the light of all this, I think that it takes a certain kind of courage to enter into a spiritual path that encourages us towards seeing, towards knowing the truth of ourselves underneath and beyond all of this conditioning that breeds so much confusion, so much anguish. This is a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye. She wrote it when she was in Colombia in 1978. It's called Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose everything. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out in the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head out of the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. In my culture, and I think it's similar here, we don't really have anything imbued, inculcated into our culture that teaches and deepens us into living the truth of interconnectedness and the essential emptiness of all accumulations. And I think that as a culture, there's a deep and quite a profound loss in this lack. The practice, the development of the heart of generosity is the seed. It's the foundation of spiritual development. Generosity is the ground of compassion. Generosity is a requisite towards the realization of liberation. So from this perspective, the greatest gift is the act of giving. Traditionally, in the teachings of the Buddha, there are three kinds of generosity that are spoken of. There's what's called beggarly giving, which is when we give with only one hand, so to say. We're still holding on to what we're giving. It's still mine. And in this kind of giving, we very often give the least of what we have. And then afterwards, we might even wonder whether we should have given it all. The second kind of giving is called friendly giving. And we give open-handedly with two hands, both hands. We take what we have and we share it, because it seems and it feels quite appropriate. It's a clear giving. And then there's what's called kingly or queenly giving. And this is when we give the best of what we have, even if none remains for ourselves. We give the best of what we have instinctively, graciously. And we think of ourselves, we actually deeply know ourselves to be only temporary caretakers of whatever's been provided and owning nothing at all, really owning nothing. And in this, there's no giving. There's just the spaciousness which allows objects to remain in their natural flow of life. The heart of generosity. The heart of compassionate generosity. There's a wonderful metaphor for this. It's the moon shining in the sky, while its image is reflected in 100 bowls of water, or reflected in every drop of water. The moon doesn't demand, if you open to me, I'll do you a favor and shine on you. The moon just shines. The point is not to want to benefit anyone or to make them happy. There's no audience involved. No me, no you, no them. It's a matter of an open gift, complete generosity without the relative notions of giving and receiving. This is from Desmond Tutu from South Africa. Africans believe in something that is difficult to render in English. We call it Ubuntu Boto. It means the essence of being human. You know when it's there and when it's absent. It speaks about humanness, gentleness, hospitality, putting yourself out on the behalf of others, being vulnerable. It embraces compassion and toughness. It recognizes that my humanity is bound up in yours, for we can only be human together. And probably needless to say, we don't always live with the purity and completeness of generosity that I described in the moon metaphor. That's why we're here, or at least in part that's why we're here. One of the reasons that we keep inclining the heart and the mind towards generosity, towards a compassionate generosity. I think it's one of the reasons that we practice. One of the most important things to remember in our practice, our Vipassana practice, and the cultivation of generosity, which is really the ground of the metta, or practice of loving kindness, compassion, and joy, is to remember we need to really be honest with ourselves. Truly honoring and respecting our capacity of heart, our capacity of mind, at any given point along the way. And not pretending anything to ourselves, not pretending anything to others, by imitating or by acting out of some idealized image that we have of a generous, compassionate, awakened being. It's important to know and to honor and respect our limits along the way, and come from a very genuine place of heart. About 12, 13 years ago, my mother quite seriously injured her leg. And she was living in Mexico at the time, and she had fallen and cut the lower part of her leg quite badly, down to the bone, in fact, but had done nothing about it. Hadn't gone to the doctor, hadn't done anything. She came to visit my brother and I in New Mexico, and I wasn't actually living in New Mexico, but I was there, and she came to visit, and her leg was quite infected by that time. So we took her to the doctor, and he said that if it wasn't cleaned out every day, down to the bone, because the infection was starting to spread up and through, that she would have to go into the hospital, and that there was a slight chance that her leg might need to be amputated. Well, we didn't want either of those things, hospital or amputation. And so who was going to do this every day at home for her? Well, nobody volunteered, so I did. And that's how it happened. I mean, I didn't jump up and say, I'll do it. Waited a little while, nobody said anything, and I said, okay, I'll do it. It was quite a journey for me to be doing this every day with her. All kinds of mind states came up. Sometimes I felt angry because she hadn't taken care of it when it happened. And now look what I had to do, you know. She's mom and I'm the daughter and I shouldn't be doing this. Sometimes I felt that. Sometimes I felt great love and great generosity and great compassion and a very open-hearted connection with her. Sometimes when I was cleaning it, and it was quite a difficult process for her because it was so painful, very, very painful, I felt my inability sometimes to be with the degree of her pain that I felt like I was causing because I was cleaning her wound. And so that would manifest sometimes as sort of disgust or anger at her, or disgust at the leg and the human flesh. And sometimes there was great compassion for her pain and connection. But the thing that was most amazing was that she never was blaming or angry or upset. She was just constantly grateful to me for doing what I was doing. Constantly thanking me. Grateful, loving, caring, which certainly helped. It was a great practice for me, and I really appreciated the practice as these days went on and I was doing this. I saw all of the different states of mind, all of the feelings coming and going and coming and going, and managed never to get stuck or caught in any of them for very long at all, more than just seconds or moments. And I had a great appreciation for the practice and great appreciation for my capacity to be honest in it. And I certainly felt all kinds of things. Through it, there was an intimacy, a deeper intimacy that developed between my mother and I. And I was certainly grateful for that also. It's important to be really honest with ourselves and our capacities at any point along the way. That's how we really learn, and not pretend anything. Sometimes we might think that we're acting with unconditional love and compassionate generosity, when in fact we might be acting out of fear of loss or fear of disapproval. Or we might be giving from a place of trying to avoid dealing directly with somebody or dealing directly in any certain situation. Giving this way actually perpetuates fear. It perpetuates the delusion. We remain in and we strengthen the closed heart of self-centeredness, the closed heart, the disconnection, the suffering in ourself and the other. And we may be creating what in a modern language, the Buddha didn't speak about it this way, but what's called codependency. Rather than cultivating the truth of a very healthy, vital connection and the natural unfolding of wisdom, of the wisdom of interconnectedness, the wisdom of selflessness. We may have a strong inner sense of need, not feeling whole, not feeling what is called ontologically okay, which means not intuitively feeling just a simple okayness about being here, being alive in this life, just because here we are, alive in this life. We may not feel that. And without this, we might have a kind of undifferentiated feeling of disconnection, kind of underneath all the time, a feeling of an inner lack of self-abundance. If we don't yet feel the strength within us of wholeness, the strength within us of abundance, this really must be respected. Otherwise, giving and caring is often done with a subtle sense, or maybe not so subtle sense, of wanting something in return. When our heart hasn't yet healed from the conditioned feelings of lack, the conditioned feelings of not enoughness, there may be a misunderstanding in relation to the truth of compassionate generosity. We might give ourselves away, or lose ourselves, so to say, in unhealthy ways, in the seeming generous support, which is actually unskillful support, of others. And when this happens, we then feel less whole. We feel more depleted. And we also may very well be ignoring or just not aware of the real needs of others and the real needs of ourselves. In relation to this, on a larger scale, Thomas Merton wrote something I like. He said, "To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns." Some words from Ralph Waldo Emerson. It's called On Success. To laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest critics, and endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition, to know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived, this is to be successful. So it's really quite important to understand, respect, and honor in ourselves and in others that the wisdom of deep and true compassionate generosity grows and matures gradually. And also to know and to remember that our limits keep changing, keep moving out, keep expanding throughout our practice. In 1996, I taught Vipassana meditation and Metta meditation in Poland. I was there for 2 months. And during that time, Tetsugen Roshi, Bernie Glassman Roshi, Zen teacher, organized the very first what he called bearing witness retreat. Some of you may have known this. The people who sat with me 2 years ago here heard a little bit about this. It was at Auschwitz, and it was on American Thanksgiving. And there were 140 people there from all over the world. the Sparing Witness retreat. I think there have been two more since then. There have been three altogether. One of the things we did, I didn't stay for the whole time, but I was there for about 3 days. And one of the things we did each evening was read, somebody would read out loud from a book, a book called An Interrupted Life, an autobiography of a young woman named Etty Hillesum. Maybe some of you are familiar with it. And I'd like to share a little bit of that with you, with a little bit of a preface. Etty was a 27-year-old Dutch Jewish woman, and she lived in a large house in Amsterdam. She was in very bad health. This was during the Second World War. And then she was taken to Westerbork concentration camp. And then she briefly was taken to Auschwitz. These years of great, enormous suffering throughout Europe were a time for Etty of enormous personal growth, paradoxically seeming. In the midst of this scenario of terrible things throughout Europe, Etty, in a sense, wrote the counter scenario. And her diaries are really an amazing account of the possibility of human beings in the midst of immense, extreme difficulty. Etty, with her very clear vision, instinctively knew that she wouldn't return from the camps. And so she had asked one of her friends to keep her diaries. Somehow she wanted to leave some trace behind and to share the solutions that she'd found for herself. So this is a little piece from her her diary. I think I'll do it anyway. I'll turn inward for half an hour each morning before work and listen to my inner voice. Lose myself. You could call it meditation. I'm still a bit wary of that word. But anyway, why not? A quiet half hour within yourself. But it's not so simple, that sort of quiet hour. It has to be learnt. A lot of unimportant inner litter and bits of pieces have to be swept out first. Even a small head can be piled high inside with irrelevant distractions. So let this be the aim of meditation. To turn one's innermost being into a vast empty plain with none of that treacherous undergrowth to impede the view, so that something of God can enter you and something of love too, not the kind of love deluxe that you revel in deliciously for half an hour, taking pride in how sublime you feel, but the love you can apply to small everyday things. And at another point, Etty wrote, mysticism must rest on crystal clear honesty and can only come after things have been stripped down to their naked reality. And this is from the last entry in her diary. Ever since last night, I've been lying here, trying to assimilate just a little of the terrible suffering that has to be endured all over the world, to accommodate just a little of the great sorrow the coming of winter has in store. It could not be done. Today will be a hard day. I shall lie quietly and try to anticipate something of all the days that are to come. When I suffer for the vulnerable, is it not for my own vulnerability that I really suffer? And she ends her diary with this. We should be willing to act as a balm for all wounds. Balm, not bomb. Salve. Balm. the survivors of the camp have confirmed that this young woman, Eddie, was an incredibly generous and luminous personality to the very last. Quite amazing. It's our inalienable right to feel whole, to feel connected, to feel ontologically okay being here, alive on the planet, simply just because we are here on the planet, alive, just like a tree, or a rabbit, or a butterfly, or grass. I think that this is one of the reasons that we're drawn to practice. It's a perfectly natural inclination to know the wholeness that's inherent in the not-self of interconnectedness. The Tibetan Buddhists have what I think is a wonderful practice, very basic practice for very stingy, very miserly people. People who have trouble even giving to themselves. So this is it. This is the practice. Take something very basic, very ordinary, something that one might not think of as particularly valuable, like a potato or maybe a turnip. And you hold it in one hand, and then you pass it to the other hand. And then you pass it back and forth and back and forth until it gets easy. Very basic practice. And if one's motivated, if one's inclined to continue the practice of generosity, one moves on to seemingly more valuable objects, either metaphorically or literally. And giving symbolically develops into letting go, relinquishing everything. All of the accumulations, the outer material accumulations, the inner accumulations of habits, preferences, ideas, beliefs, etc. And it's even spoken of as relinquishing the secret holdings. We do it every day in Rupa Lila, symbolically. In the Tibetan practice, its final stage is done ideally with a mound of precious jewels that are symbolically offered over and over and over and over again to the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha, and to all beings. At one point I did this practice, but instead of precious jewels, I had a big pile of rice, which seemed actually quite appropriate to have rice, kind of like potatoes, you know, basic. Relinquishing, letting go, all of the holdings. That's what we're doing here. This is our practice, without all of the paraphernalia that one can use in doing it another way. As we relinquish, as we let go of the forces that bind us, as we practice non-clinging, stopping the identification with the habit energies of, for instance, greed or anger, jealousy, fear, we begin to see through them, as I've talked about some. As we more and more often get to know these energies. To experience these energies as not solid, not substantial forces, not me, not mine, but as ephemeral thoughts just flitting through the mind, as changing sensations coming and going, often quite quickly. As we begin to see through these forces that bind us, they are no longer able to hold water, so to say. Our clear seeing makes holes in the bucket, and transformation begins to happen. And then the beautiful qualities, the energies of unconditional care, loving kindness, compassion, joy, tranquility, calm, balance, equanimity of heart, of mind, generosity, then have the ground and the space to grow and to flourish. And our limits that seem so set begin to open out. We begin to experience a great spaciousness of heart, a great spaciousness of heart and mind that's grounded in a sense of calm, confidence, clarity, and a sense of connection or interconnection to beings, to life, is experienced in very tangible ways. As we practice and manifest generosity, we begin to see and to feel ourselves changing and growing. The development and the deepening of the quality of generosity counteracts the energies that limit us, the energies that bind and constrict us. The development of generosity is a very powerful antidote to craving, this endless, strong wanting and clinging. In the largest sense, generosity isn't about giving away anything. It's really about this inner quality of non-clinging, the inner quality of letting go, of relinquishing. The practice of generosity very powerfully opens us to these liberating energies, the liberating energies of letting go, relinquishing. In this sense, our practice is really a seamless circle that keeps expanding outward with no fixed line delineating a bounded edge. We learn the truth of giving and receiving, the natural law of giving and receiving, and the balance in this. And it's important to begin to see ourselves in this balance and not give out of some imagined idea of perfection, as I've already mentioned. We must really start right where we are, within whatever our capacity is at any given point in our life. If we start here and we keep practicing, it's inevitable that our limits will expand, will move out. And amazingly, we begin to find out that there's really nothing to hold on to, no matter how hard we try. There's a story, it's usually told as a joke, about an extremely very wealthy man who died. And at his funeral, people were talking, gossiping, kind of talking about his great, enormous wealth, and kind of wondering about it. And someone asked, well, how much did he leave? How much did he leave? And one very wise person said, why, everything, of course. So it is. Learning to give, learning to receive, letting go of control, and receiving what's given. Receiving each moment of our life just as it is, whether pleasant or unpleasant, with the trust that it's just right, just enough for our spiritual growth to unfold from. We can give ourselves the gift of truly learning to be in the present moment with a clear, mindful awareness, receiving the present moment with gratitude, with appreciation, with humility. We can learn to apply the wise attention of mindful awareness in the midst of any exchange, any relationship, any emotional state, any sensation that moves through our body, the smell of rain, the touch of the wind on our skin, to any task that we might be engaged in, to the experience of a breath, from its birth all the way through to its death. Like the Bodhisattva Sumedha, who with such great dedication and open-heartedness practiced and learned, we too can learn to receive life fully, to be kind, grateful, generous, knowing that this very life is the path, our path, to contentment, to the deepest ease of well-being and joy. We too can learn that this very life is our path to enlightenment, and that our liberation, is intimately and profoundly connected to the liberation of all beings. Someone once asked Gandhi, a bodhisattva of our time, "Why do you give so much? Why do you serve all these people?" And Gandhi answered, "I don't give to anyone. I do it all for myself." In truth, the aim, the fruit of generosity, is twofold. We give to help, to free others, and we give to help, to free ourselves. This is really the fullness, the seamless circle of generosity. As the energy of it grows and flows within us, like the great rivers of the world, flowing naturally, we begin to know it deeply and to live it quite naturally as who we are. I'd like to close with a short piece that was written by Jack Kerouac. Some of you may have heard of Jack Kerouac. He was one of the very first beatniks, pre-hippie, my generation. He was an admired person by many of us in high school, those that were a little not in the middle of American life. And he wrote a lot of things, one famous book called On the Road that maybe some of you are familiar with or have heard of. This is before that. And it's from a book or a treatise called The Scripture of the Golden Eternity. And he was a Buddhist. He was one of the first American Buddhists. He and a bunch of others, the old beatnik crowd. Quite radical people in a certain way. The language is very flowery, and I debated whether to read it or not because it's not your first language here, but I think you can get it. I'll read it slowly. Discard such definite imaginations of phenomena as your own self, thou human being. Thou art a numberless mass of sun motes, each mote a shrine. The same as to your shyness of other selves, be it selfness as divided into infinite numbers of other beings, or selfness as identified as one self existing eternally. Be obliging and noble. Be generous with your time and help and possessions, and be kind, because the emptiness of this little place of flesh you carry around and call your soul, your entity, is the same emptiness in every direction of space. Unmeasurable emptiness. The same one and holy emptiness everywhere. Why be selfie and unfree? Man, God, woman, God. Wait, let me start that again. Why be selfie and unfree, man, God, woman, God, caught in your dream? Wake up. Thou art selfless and free. Let's sit for a moment.